So, with that said, welcome. And I'm going to start off the day with the security panel. We have 9 speakers we're going to bring out. They're going to introduce themselves briefly, talk about the area of technology that interests them, what they're up to, where they see technology moving, and then we'll move on to some questions from the audience. So while you're listening to them introduce themselves, start thinking about maybe some questions you'd like them to answer. Maybe it's on a specific technical issue. Maybe it's on a broad general trend in the industry. But keep something in mind. And once we're done with introductions, we'll move on to questions from the audience. So that said, I'm going to introduce David Litchfield from NGS Software from the United Kingdom. Welcome, David. Gerhard Eschelbeck from Qualys. Yay, Gerhard. Haribu Seki from Security Friday. Johnny Long from Computer Sciences Corporation. Famous for his Google hacking. Caesar, a.k.a. Riley Eller, from Coco Communications. Known for organizing Capture the Flag at DEF CON. Charles Vanderwald from SensePost in South Africa. Russ Rogers from Security Horizon. Joe Grand from Grand Idea Studio, formerly from The Law. Chris Eagle from the Naval Postgraduate School in California. And finally, Yuji Yukai from EI Digital Security. We also have Denji Sanai, also from Security Friday. So one of these is a wireless microphone. I want to start off with David Litchfield on the right, and we'll work our way down the panel. When we get to the end, it is time for audience questions and participation. So you've been warned. Yeah, just brief intro, where you see the technology going, what interests you. This is going to go way too fast. We're going to need questions quickly. It's up to you guys to talk for a long time. This is going way too fast. Okay, you guys need to spend a lot more time talking because they're going way too fast. Yeah, you want to talk about that fact.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell Rogers. I am the CEO and co-founder of Security Horizon, an information security company out of Colorado in the United States. My primary interest at this time is in using covert channels and steganography to slip information through security mechanisms that would normally catch information slipping through. Basically, we're talking about digital images, audio files, we're talking about network covert channels, other things that our current security devices don't look for. There's no way to pick up a specific signature at this time. I'll be speaking tomorrow on this topic as well as discussing what the current state of covert channels is, what technology exists today, as well as what the future of covert channels holds. It could be things like combining multiple groups of files to hide information in, different protocols, ways to alter IPsec header information, things like that. I've got an associate degree in advanced communication technology, a bachelor's degree in computer information systems, and a master's degree from the University of Maryland in the United States in computer systems management. I've been on staff with DEF CON for just about 7 or 8 years.
And you were a Fed?
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Grant. I'm the president of Grand Idea Studio. I do product development, electrical engineering, and analysis of security-based hardware products. I am was a member of the LOC,
Now that we've all introduced the speakers and themselves, we're going to move on to a question and answer session with the audience. Before that begins, though, I think some of the speakers have questions that they wish to ask of each other. We'll use this to warm up the panel, and then we'll move on to the audience. So, anybody in the panel have a question they want to share with each other? David Litchfield. Riley. So basically, interactive shells, I think, is what he's getting at. Or phone calls, yeah.
Phone calls, video conferences, that kind of thing. With the development of the high-speed protocol standards that are being released, as you mentioned earlier, the RTP, the real-time protocols we're talking about, that will send information in small payloads very quickly. I believe that is possible in the future. I believe we're very close to that. The problem, again, comes back to the security industry's inability to detect those kinds of anomalies in the network traffic. So I do believe that we can move large payloads of information over an extended period of time. Now, if you were talking about real-time video or voice, I believe that's what they are.
I think Charles had a question.
acceptably releasing this information to anyone who can use it, and have become aware of the problem and started fixing their problem. Obviously, that's not going to be approval.
Anybody coming? Wow, what a great question. Okay, I think we could keep going all day on some panel questions, but I want to take a quick break. Are there any questions from the audience at this point? We have two microphones set up for anybody who wishes to ask the panelists a question. And if not, I'm going to have to call on audience members that I know personally. Questions? Okay, Tom. I know you have something you wish to ask us. I'm sorry, the question is, you'd like our opinion on how to protect against... Oh, buffer overflows, and how the buffer overflow protection techniques may impact overall performance. Okay. Does anybody have an opinion on that? David Litchfield, the resident buffer overflow expert. Does this panel end? No, 12:30. It ends at 1:50. Okay, so this is going to last forever, so we might have to end a little early.
That said, the technology is
So when you say change in architecture, are you referring to, say, like AMD 64 CPU with the NX bit? Or are you talking about a complete software architecture change? Right. But the short-term problem that we're dealing with today is we're putting band-aids on operating systems to try to lock down heap memory or stack memory. Right. I think as a consumer and not the vendor, you have to live with these problem products, and so then you're really stuck with what third-party solutions. Right, they're famous. Right, so as an interim solution, you would advise everybody, if you're on a Windows platform, you'd be a fool not to move to a technology like SP2.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so I want to see as a show of hands by the panel here, how many people think that there will be no overflow in XP, SP2? Yeah. Okay. Smaller. Right. The bar has been raised so high now that very few people are left with the skills to find the exploit. Right. Next. Okay, so that was a long answer to your question. Thank you. Anybody else have a question they'd like to ask our panel? Sir, the... Guessing this is for you.
Based on the protection of the people, that's wrong.
Oh, okay. In SP2? Or in general? The question was heap protection mechanisms for heap overflows.
What about?
I have no idea.
Okay.
So, as far as I understand the question, it was what steps in charge of the there's something that we can do to help against Arctic polar ice cores. And in fact, Microsoft has done so with their SDS2. In terms of protecting against data corruption, for example, let's say indeed there is something, a keyword, that says whether I'm an administrator or not. If I go and follow the keyface button and set that keyword to allow me, that makes me look like I'm an administrator or group or whatever kind of thing, then there's not a lot at this moment that can be done to protect against that kind of thing without impacting performance too much. You could, however, of course, have your key management structures and constantly monitor those key management structures. And if one of those gets overwritten, then, kill your process. But that's going to really impact performance, I think. Secondly to that, if we look at a more operating system, there's no randomness within the key management structures. So even if we check and keep management control structures, we could overflow it with data that exactly matches that data that was there before. So assuming that
yes, I think they do.
Assuming we overwrite whatever it is that we say, well, we can defeat that by introducing privilege, which is what Microsoft has done in this case. They've introduced a privilege of the heat management control structures to ensure that even if we know about heat control structures, that we don't think we have to predict release what the values of the control structures.
So, are you familiar with then with any operating systems that currently implement a randomized heap structure?
Yeah.
Okay, and besides that? Okay. So this isn't something that's theoretical. This is implemented in commercial operating systems right now. The patch for Linux. I think you said Apache. Oh, PAX, P-A-X, Stack Protection. Yeah, Johnny? Right. I think a very small percentage of overflows are even reachable through user code paths. So, window. Oh, use the microphone. Yeah. I actually have a question for Chris Eagle. While I'm not a reverse engineer, it's a topic near and dear to my heart. With more and more viruses being obfuscated, and programs like, Ada Pro, the only tool really a lot of reverse engineers use, it seems like the attackers started with a program like BurnEye to obfuscate, and then some guys in Australia developed Shiva to obfuscate, which you came up with a brilliant solution against their obfuscation. I'm wondering, this is now turning into an arms race, and it seems like there's going to be a divergence in time to respond to a new obfuscation technique. What is your perception of where we'll be a year from now with this obfuscation? Because it seems like once the attackers get so good at obfuscating a new virus, it could be weeks, months, potentially, right, until any virus vendor has a time. And that will fundamentally change the dynamic of how system administrators try to defend. Ooh, it got turned off when it dropped. There you go.
Okay, I think it is an arms race. The obfuscators, every time a new obfuscation appears, there is some effort to understand how that obfuscation works. confiscation by this kind of fact. One virus might be presented to Shiva, a second virus might be presented to Shiva, will look quite different. So, unless you use the inner workings of Shiva itself, these things come out to be trivial to the person who's in the world. I think that where I see the direction going would be that rather than one of the reasons obfuscators are used is to get the code past signature protection engine, don't understand what's inside that binary. Maybe the decision is malicious or not malicious, keep it out and let it in. Once you understand the obfuscation technique and the diversity out there, you can defend it very quickly. If instead of trying to protect the malicious software, we come up with almost polymorphic obfuscators, then I can take a virus A, and obfuscate it, send it around. If I obfuscate it the second time, no longer looks up. All the signatures no longer look the same.
Right.
So I can get that same virus through.
Multi-use,
And then when new defenses are built, I obfuscate it another time and we can sail through yet again.
Right. So this might actually accelerate the system administrator having to patch the core problem and not relying on band-aids like antivirus to save them. That's a waste of energy, you think? Put that energy toward fixing the core problem.
Yeah.
Well, so you see, a year from now, more and more tools like Shiva. I mean, are we on the cusp of an avalanche of obfuscators? Any other questions from the audience? Oh, he already spoke on this earlier.
Like that, you know,
So I have a related question then. In your experience, how difficult is it to get yourself out of Google? Let's say you made a mistake, some information was available on the web, it got Googled, it got cached in Google, and you fix your website, it's still available, the vulnerability information is still in the cache. Have you had any experience in figuring out how in the heck you get yourself out of Google? Sir? We'll start with the Japanese experts on the left, and or your right, and move to the left. I know just through looking through our Black Hat logs, we see a majority of traffic coming from the Korean country, South Korea mostly. I think they must be a juicy target because of their highly available broadband and a lot of home users with unsecured machines. So I think that's a factor, and I think as more and more Japanese get broadband online, I think they'll be facing the same problem. Does anybody else have a comment or an observation about the attacks in the Asian region? Sir? I recently got a phone call from BBC Radio wanting me to comment on this topic because the South Koreans made an announcement that the North Koreans had a really active offensive information warfare program. And so I started reading articles on this, and it seems that people in South Korea have been making announcements about the North Korean offensive infowar program since about 1992. And they've been making various claims about how advanced the North Koreans are, anywhere from saying that they have been doing 100 cyber warriors a year for the last 20 years, which doesn't make sense because North Korea would have had vacuum tubes back then. So I think there's a lot of misinformation about what the capabilities of the North Koreans are, but there were articles specifically mentioning cooperation between the North Koreans and the Chinese, and then the Chinese carrying out basically the attacks against, say, South Korea or Japan. So I think there's sort of a group of responsibility, but so far I couldn't find a single bit of literature saying that they'd identified a government-sponsored North Korean attack. So that said, I think the only person that might have some legitimate knowledge might be Chris Eagle, but he may not be able to comment on it due to his position. Thank you. I remember years ago, a UK hacker who ended up getting caught used to bounce through North Korean machines because he figured since nobody likes North Koreans, there was no way they would share their logs with any Western power, and it was a perfect place to cleanse his connections. So countries like that sometimes are actually unwitting launch points for Western hackers. They just figure that they're not going to get any cooperation from the local government. Does anybody on the panel have a comment on that? Then we'll move on to another question. We have about maybe 7 minutes remaining. I have one observation to follow up on what Chris said. When the Chinese hackers got really active attacking the U.S. around the time of that P3 incident, a friend of mine found his way into some Chinese IRC groups, and he managed to lurk, and all he did was cut and paste all the strings from IRC into some universal translator to try to figure out what in the world they were talking about. And over the course of a couple days, a trend emerged, and what would happen is all the hackers would gather there, basically the script kiddies, and one or two senior Chinese hackers would come along, and they would basically present them, here's the exploit, here's how to target the machine, you try these IP address ranges, and give them a 10-step plan exactly how to perform an attack. It was like a textbook, do these 10 steps to break in. And then the 150 or 200 people that were in these IRC rooms would take the instructions and go do the attack. So really there, it was like two instructors and about 200 followers. And so it made them very suspicious. It wasn't like it was an unorganized, random, college students hacking. It was highly organized. So that, I guess, would point towards some kind of governmental. You can't say that 200 hackers got together and attacked something without the government knowing about it in China, I would think. Okay, let's take one or two more questions before we start our general sessions. Okay, so I think that the question then is to summarize, basically the half-life of from a time a zero-day is created to the time it's used. First, how frequently is it used before it's detected? How much damage is done during that private phase? So I think I have a bit of a follow-up for Gerhard, who makes a business out of collecting statistics on attacks, both network and host-based attacks. So I'm wondering, while you might not know how long a zero-day has been out, what's your experience in how long they last once they become public?
And
Did that help at all? Okay. All right, I think we're out of time for this Ask the Experts panel. Hopefully that has introduced you to some of the speakers you'll be seeing here. Please feel free to go up and ask them questions you may not have had time to ask them right now. And with that said, we're going to break into our individual sessions and start up the rest of the show. Also, please don't forget to stay for the reception this evening after the last speech. Thank you.